Okay, we had a little issue there, but we resolved it. That was the great and legendary Yomo Toro of Puerto Rico, the master of the cuatro en tres with sangre boricua, Puerto Rican blood. He died earlier this year, tragically, at the age of 79. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Monday, November the 12th. And although the weekend has been quite interesting news-wise, with all that Sturm und Drang about clandestine military maneuvers of a romantic kind, despite all that, we proceed with our discussion on the aftermath of the election. Trust me, a lot more will be known by the time we get to General Petraeus later this week. But for now, we turn to Puerto Rico, where on November the 6th, coinciding with the general elections, history of a sort was made. For the first time in their history, a majority of Puerto Ricans officially made it clear that they want to change their relationship with Washington. They want Puerto Rico to be America's 51st state. Dr. Carlos Vargas Ramos of the Manhattan-based Center for the Puerto Rican Studies helps us understand the significance of that referendum. Dr. Vargas Ramos is a research associate at the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College of the City University of New York. It is the only university-based research institute in the United States devoted solely to the study of the Puerto Rican experience in the diaspora. It is the oldest and largest Latino research and archival institution in the Northeast and boasts the world's only repository of archival and library materials dedicated exclusively to the Puerto Rican experience. Dr. Vargas is a political scientist, studies the impact of migration on Puerto Rican political behavior, political attitudes, and orientations. He co-edited Blessing La Política, the Latino Religious Experience and Political Engagement in the United States, which was published this year, is working on another book, Abroad and at Home, Puerto Rican Political Engagement in the Caribbean and in the United States, and is editing an anthology on Puerto Ricans and race. Thanks so much for being with us, Carlos.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot. Now, tell us about the significance of this vote. 61%, a sizable vote, favored making Puerto Rico the 51st state. 33% said they prefer to stay with a Commonwealth arrangement, and only 5.53% said they favored full independence for Puerto Rico. How do you interpret the result of that referendum?
Right. I have a different interpretation than what you just outlined. The consultation to the electors in Puerto Rico was split into two. The first one was in establishing whether Puerto Rico's electorate wanted to preserve the status that it currently has with the United States, meaning the Commonwealth status or free associated state, as it would translate from the Spanish. And that was a clear no. People want to change the current status by a range of over 50%. After that was established, voters had a choice of what status options to maintain. They don't want to maintain the current status. What would they choose instead? And undoubtedly, those who wanted Puerto Rico to become a state of the union obtained what I would say is a plurality of the vote cast in that election for that question. Those who wanted a different type of Commonwealth relationship, one that would afford Puerto Rico even greater autonomy than it already has, had over 400,000 votes. But most significant is that about a quarter of the people who cast their votes voted in blank for those options. So to reaffirm the historical nature of the question, I think that the ingenious way of posing the question, which is, would you like to preserve the current status, yes or no, that was very clear. The majority of Puerto Ricans do not want to maintain the current status. What options to choose instead, that is less clear. a plurality of the vote cast definitely wants Puerto Rico to become a state, but you still have other options that are not necessarily favoring Puerto Rico becoming a state.
Well, that is interesting because the poll results are saying something entirely different. I'm glad that you put that mm-hmm. in proper perspective for us.
Yes.
That's the first thing. That's very interesting. So now that we have this choice, where are people now? It's a non-binding referendum.
That's correct, and that is critical because what people need to understand is that had Congress authorized, had this plebiscite or referendum taken place under the aegis of the U.S. Congress, it would have been binding on the Congress. It is not. This is just a consultation from the local voters in Puerto Rico trying to ascertain what status they want and what status they do not want. So it is clear they do not want to maintain their current status. The clear alternative to the present status might be statehood, but it is not endorsed by the majority of the voters. Again, I am making the distinction about the majority of the voters who cast their votes because even though it has been presented that 61% of 1.3 million ballots favored statehood, actually 1.8 million voters went to the polls and voted on that question. So depending on how you, on the denominator you use to make the comparison, you could establish whether it is a majority of voters favoring statehood or simply a plurality of voters choosing statehood.
In any event, I want to come to the non-binding idea here.
Mm-hmm.
You clearly indicated that this were it, quote, serious, a very serious issue that would have been decided by popular vote, it would have been authorized by Congress. Why wasn't it?
Because the Congress has no incentive to resolve this matter. The Congress has been punting on the question of on the status of Puerto Rico since 1950. It dodged the bullet in 1967 when you had a plebiscite on whether to maintain the current status. And from that point on, all the efforts to change the status of Puerto Rico have come because of pressure from the electorate in Puerto Rico, not from the Congress of the United States, which, by the way, legally and formally holds sovereignty over Puerto Rico. We can discuss whether sovereignty can be maintained by another nation, but legally, in international law, Puerto Rico, the United States has sovereignty over Puerto Rico presently.
The outgoing governor, Luis Fortuño, his new progressive party advocated statehood.
Yes.
But the incoming governor, Alejandro Garcia Padilla, who won the gubernatorial contest, is favoring Commonwealth status. Now, this is, in fact, a kind of microcosm of just where the island is. It's completely up in the air as to where people want to go.
It is up in the air, yes, to some extent. It is clear that the majority of voters do not want Puerto Rico to continue its present status. It is also clear that Puerto Ricans do not want to become independent. So the choices are basically between maintaining kind of an autonomy within the within a relationship with the United States or joining the United States as a member in equal footing with other 50 states in the union.
What are the advantages from the point of view of being a commonwealth, what are the advantages of statehood? What is at play? What are the underlying issues that would tip the scale in either favor?
Well, proponents of commonwealth status really do not see an advantage for statehood. The proponents for statehood, however, advocate, and correctly so, that Puerto Ricans in the island would have equal footing with any other U.S. citizens within the confines of the United States. They would have, for instance, at minimum 6 members of the House of Representatives, which would provide more political power than 23 or 24 states of the Union as presently constituted. It would provide 2 U.S. senators. So it would provide a lot of political power for Puerto Rico that it currently does not have.
And for statehood?
This is for statehood.
For Commonwealth?
For Commonwealth, it would, it presumably maintain the current status, which is, just one quote-unquote resident commissioner, that is the official title of the delegate from Puerto Rico to the U.S. Congress, who is a member who can, speak on the floor of the House, but really cannot cast any vote on behalf of the almost 4 million residents of Puerto Rico.
Given the emergence of the Latino voting bloc as a pivotal point in the electoral landscape now, how does this referendum indicate a growing desire to resolve this question in Congress?
The status of Puerto Rico, as I mentioned before, is not an issue of interest in the U.S. Congress, and it isn't either an issue of interest in the electorate in the United States, even within Latino groups, with the exception of the Puerto Rican segment of the Latino electorate, and you could qualify that as well. So it is not a pressing issue politically at the present.
Okay. I wanted to know about the role of the Puerto Rican diaspora.
Yes.
Does the diaspora reflect pretty much the same feelings and sentiments as Puerto Ricans in Puerto Rico?
Well, at present, it is hard to tell. About 20 years ago, when a survey of Latinos in the United States was conducted, including Puerto Ricans, a majority of Puerto Ricans in the United States favored the present status, meaning Commonwealth status. And about 40% had favor, or just under 40% had favored statehood. Since 1990, when that survey was conducted, no new national survey posing that question has been conducted, so it is unclear whether those proportions have changed. I would suspect that the advocates of statehood for Puerto Rico may have increased in the United States, among Puerto Ricans in the United States, but not necessarily to become either a majority or even a plurality.
Even so, Puerto Ricans in the United States, are they permitted to vote for president?
In the United States, Puerto Ricans enjoy all the rights of any other citizen of the United States, so long as they are in the United States proper. Once they go back to Puerto Rico, they lose those political powers.
So let me ask this question. It's a technical question here. Could there be a situation where Puerto Ricans wanting to be, that they have, in fact, the best of both worlds, they can opt in or opt out?
Right. I mean, and that has been an argument that the advocates of the present status have been making for a very long time. If Puerto Rico were to remain a territory as presently defined, Puerto Ricans could continue coming back and forth between the United States and Puerto Rico. They would be able to vote in the United States elections if they resided in the United States. They would, be participating in the political process in Puerto Rico if they so chose. And they would, have autonomy in terms of, what their culture would represent, whether they wanted to maintain an essentially Hispanic, Latin American, Caribbean culture, as opposed to one that would conform more with a North American, Anglo-Saxon norms.
But the underlying question really is it fair that any group could have such an option in the sense that they could actually be, if they so chose, that they have options that the average American citizen doesn't have, in a way that could sway an election simply by virtue of Commonwealth status? They have a greater political latitude than most citizens.
Well, not quite. I mean, Puerto Ricans on the island cannot vote in any federal election. and therefore they would have no impact whatsoever on the general elections in the United States. Just like the residents of the U.S. Virgin Islands cannot do that, or the residents of American Samoa cannot do that either. However, any person that chose to establish residence in Puerto Rico, whether they were coming from Idaho or Illinois or Kansas and decided to move to Puerto Rico, they themselves, if they are permanent residents of Puerto Rico, would lose the right to vote in federal elections in the United States.
Well, we have a plebiscite nonetheless, and it did produce something in the way of a gauge of how Puerto Ricans are feeling about their current political status.
That's correct.
Now, what happens with this information? What happens with the results of the plebiscite now, as you see it?
Right. As I see it, the advocates for statehood are likely to push further to petition the Congress to admit Puerto Rico into the Union. Opponents for statehood in Puerto Rico will similarly say that they do not have a mandate to make such a petition. The Congress will try to avoid picking up the issue along with the White House, and the issue will remain the same.
Is there any indication that there's movement with respect to putting this on the Latino agenda for the next Congress?
I think that within the Latino agenda, they would tend to do what other elected officials and political entrepreneurs are doing, which is to defer to the Puerto Rican members of Congress and Puerto Rican elected officials in the United States to advocate the issue themselves and give leadership and direction to other Latino elected officials throughout the country.
Well, thank you very much for joining us and giving us this briefing. And I want to come back to you for a more detailed presentation on the political relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States.
Thank you very much. I'll be happy to.
Thank you so much. We'll take this break and come back for the other half of this question, which is statehood and Washington, D.C. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, I'm Utrice Lead. And the previous topic gives us a nice little segue into a related matter closer to home, and that is the District of Columbia, where for more than 200 years there has been an effort to try and get the District of Columbia declared a state. We are joined now by James Jones of DC Vote, an organization that has been lobbying for this very effort. Thanks so much, James, for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Utrice. Happy to talk.
Thank you. Now, tell me where things are post-election.
Well, the election didn't, you know, change things all that much in Congress for us. Congress has been difficult for D.C. For many, many years. We obviously don't have statehood. We do not have a vote in Congress. And just as a, you know, I need to back up just a little bit to let people know what our status is. Like Puerto Rico, we have a delegate. The difference between D.C. and Puerto Rico, of course, is that we pay federal taxes and always have. So we are taxed and do not have representation. Thus, if you go to D.C., you will see what our license plates say. Our state motto, our city motto now, is taxation without representation. That said, I don't think the election changes the landscape all that much. What we have been shooting for over the last several years We haven't gone for a statehood vote at this point. That has not been our effort in the last several years, because there have been plenty of issues where we are trying to make some incremental improvements to our status, because the district is in such a, for lack of a better term, colonial status in relation to the Congress, that we don't even have control over our own local tax dollars, ultimately. We don't have control over our own legislation passed by our own legislature. People who we did not elect who are in Congress are making political decisions for the people of the District of Columbia. So we're going to fight that at every single fight, in addition to continuing our push for statehood. But, you know, if you look at the election, I mean, President Obama and frankly, the Democrats have been supportive of you know, increasing self-determination for the District of Columbia. I mean, we vote Democratic 90%, you know, they have been supportive. But when it really comes down to it, for the tough votes, for instance, we recently had a bill going through a couple years back, and then as recently as this last Congress, that would have given us greater autonomy. The NRA and the National Right to Life Committee now have begun just plopping their amendments onto those bills, which has the effect of killing those bills, because so many Democrats will be afraid to vote against the NRA and against the National Right to Life Committee. So the Democrats are much more supportive of our cause, but when it really comes down to it, self-interest always trumps moving, you know, almost 700,000 Americans into the modern age in terms of civil rights. So that's where it sort of stands right now. And the Congress has, you know, we have repeatedly been pushing legislation to give us greater self-determination, to give us statehood, and Congress has figured it out. Our opponents in Congress have pretty much figured out that they can just put on these poison amendments, and the people of D.C. will say, you know what, we're not willing to do that here in return for a vote in Congress or a greater amount of budget autonomy, because it doesn't really mean anything if Congress is telling us what to do while at the same time saying we're giving you more power. So what we have decided on, I don't want to go too far on this because you may have questions about Puerto Rico, but what we have decided on, a more local strategy, which is that our council, when it was created by the Congress, we are a creation of the Congress, provided for citizen referenda on many, many issues. It also explicitly said what we couldn't vote on, which is, you know, rather undemocratic in and of itself. But since we have been thwarted by Congress, we have decided, and our city council is now moving legislation that would put a referendum on the ballot, that if the D.C. voters support it, which we expect they will overwhelmingly, that the district would, for the first time, have control over its own local tax dollars. Now, I know that sounds insane, but the reality is we pay federal taxes, and we also pay local taxes, just like anybody else who pays state and federal taxes. Our state taxes go into our budget. We pass a budget. And it sits there. It sits there, and we cannot spend new dollars until the Congress passes an appropriations bill for us. And that creates a lot of problems, particularly in the last several years, when we've had close to a government shutdown three different times. Each of those times, the district has to prepare a plan to shut down. We're just treated like a federal agency. No different. So anyway, we're trying to get over that now. That's sort of where things stand right now.
So in this regard, I want to ask a question. You said that the Democrats are a bit amenable, and the president has been amenable. But in fact, just this year, when it came time to incorporate D.C. statehood into the party's platform, it just didn't happen.
Right. Well, when you say it came time to incorporate it, it wasn't there. D.C. Vote is not a partisan organization. We were not, I mean, I just have to say it right up front, we were not involved at all in what happens with the platform of the Democratic or the Republican Party.
The opportunity seemed to be there to take this into the political arena in a decisive way. Why didn't it happen?
It's a very peculiar thing that occurred, and we were pretty stunned by it, frankly, because the Democratic Party has supported statehood, and you know, as people probably know, statehood is not the only option for giving us representation, and there's been a long debate over that, but the fact of the matter is statehood does get us what we need. And so we have always pushed for statehood as part of the Democratic platform. I will say also that we have found that the Democratic platform on this issue has not been very binding on people, frankly. But the Democrats have tended to support statehood, and this year they did not. Now, I wish I could tell you why that happened. I don't know why that happened. Our delegate to the Congress, also we have always had a speech at the Democratic convention. Our delegate to the Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, has always been able to deliver a speech on the issue of D.C. statehood and our rights as Americans. That did not occur either. So, I have to say, some responsibility, I would assume, has to lie with our own local Democratic Party and their, questions about their ability to influence the process, whether it be they don't have enough resources, whether they figure it, they got complacent, whether the Democratic Party is complacent about us because we always vote for them. I'm not really sure why it happened. I would be completely floored 4 years from now if statehood was not put back in. The Democrats didn't want to change anything at the last minute. And frankly, our political leadership sometimes, when it comes to operating within the Democratic Party and even within the Congress, is a lot more cautious and is looking at things more in the longer run, perhaps, than a lot of our activists, where they feel like they have to maintain certain relationships in order to get things done in Congress and to get a statehood. And D.C. Vote, like I said, we don't take positions on party platforms. We're very grateful that both our local Democratic Party and our local Republican Party support statehood for the District of Columbia and support every effort to expand self-determination, regardless of what party. That's unfortunate. And at the same time, I guess I have to be frank and say that, we have been disappointed fairly consistently over the last decade when it came to our friends, when our friends really, really needed to stand up for us. Once again, that's why we are now pursuing a two-track strategy, a strategy based on the legal authority we think we have in D.C., as well as continuing to work hard in Congress and get them to pass bills that give us greater autonomy and eventually leading to statehood, because eventually it won't really matter anymore because we'll be heading down that road to statehood. The big difference will be we'll actually have representation.
Well, here's an interesting observation. This discussion of statehood began in the crucible of a very African-American identity in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely.
Overwhelmingly black district, led by African-Americans and so forth.
Right.
And am I out on a limb here by suggesting that perhaps they're waiting for the complete change to occur as it is now? Washington, D.C. is being gentrified. The last time I was there, which was just a couple of months ago, I couldn't believe the degree to which basically African-American neighborhoods were either completely obliterated or were overhauled.
Yeah.
Gentrified. Is there a correlation there? Do you think that the efforts for statehood would take on a greater seriousness in the eyes of the political establishment if the population were to look a little bit different in Washington, D.C.?
There is no doubt that race has been at the front and center of our struggle for the last 200 years. I mean, it's no secret that that's one of the issues. I think those who would make that argument, I'm not sure I can't say that that's a tipping point. I do not feel that the same racial, not too long ago, when we were trying to become a state in 1978, when we were trying to get two votes in the Senate and a vote in the House, there is no doubt that the coalition of Southern Democrats and the Republicans were doing what they were doing in terms of opposing it because of race, flat, you know, front and center race. You could, back then, people would even say it was about race, you know. They wouldn't, they didn't care. They'd say it's about two Democratic senators and a Democratic member. I don't, you know, this notion that D.C., I mean, D.C. is majority, is, I'd say African-Americans are now not the majority in D.C. That is the fact. And, you know, if there's been a change in attitude because of that, I haven't seen it. The Congress in both parties have not made this a high priority. Gentrification is reality. One of the you know, at least from one perspective, is we are gaining residents as these new residents move in. We are not losing as much population, African-American, traditional African-American population, as we did in the late 1980s, when people fled because of just the collapse of the school system. It wasn't a gentrification. So the African-American middle class fled D.C. in huge numbers between 1989 and 2000. And that was before, you know, when you talk about gentrification, that was before the big influx of, you know, I mean, frankly, young white people. And so, you know, our gentrification has a lot of problems and a lot of stress, just like anybody else's. But we are seeing a slowdown in the, you know, in African Americans leaving the city. But that said, I think that is a bit of an oversimplification. It is a factor. Don't get me wrong. D.C. will always be seen, I think, as a black city. The politically active part of the city is African American. The white people in D.C. strongly identify with the African American nature of the city themselves. If you've lived here, I mean, I've lived here 25 years, and you know, it is part of our city that is going to be the character of the city forever. So I don't think numbers are going to matter. If we become, you know, if only 40% of the population is African American and the rest is, you know, white and Hispanic and other ethnic groups, I really don't see that happening. I think the reason why the attitudes may change somewhat is because, you know, first of all, it just makes perfect sense. It makes sense, and it has been stalled by partisanship for so long, and there are so many issues philosophically in agreement that Democrats and Republicans would have on the basis as to why people of the District of Columbia should be treated like Americans. And I just think, you know, the movement has reached a point where it's stronger because we do have every part of the city represented in our movement. We have, you know, we have African Americans that are longtime activists. We have students. We have people from the more wealthy portions of D.C. that are white that contribute money. And I just think that we're going to make progress. We're not, you know, because of, you know, really sticking with our fight. And we're going to have to get dramatic, you know, which goes back to our new approach, which is we're going to pass this referendum, and it's going to become law when we do. And we have little doubt that the Congress will try to overturn it. There will be some members of Congress who want to try to keep us from getting that. And when that happens, we're going to be out all over the country in the faces of those Congress people who have decided that they're going to try to reverse the will of the people of the District of Columbia. And we think that that kind of an effort is going to get noticed. And you're going to, and when you see the people that are out there doing it, you're going to see people not only from D.C., but from the other districts. And when people see what D.C. looks like, you know, I'm telling you, it's still going to look pretty African American to people, in terms of the people that are going to be out there protesting. But you know, you're going to have a pretty big cross section. We're going to look a lot like America is what we're going to look like.
What, therefore, is your timeline, and what is the agenda in the short term?
In the short term, it's very quick. Our council is going to vote on this bill in a couple of weeks, and then vote on it again. We have two votes before they leave for Christmas. As luck would have it, and good planning, on our part. There's going to be a special election because we had a an open chairman seat, and the fellow who won it was held another council seat. So we're going to have a citywide special election to fill that person's seat, and at that time, the referendum will also be on the ballot, and we expect it to win. And we're very excited because we get to have a campaign. We get to help. We get to educate people. We get to get our activists fired up about something, and we think that's important. And then the fight really begins. You know, there are some people who might want to sue us because they don't want us to do this. Some people related to Congress in some way. That would happen pretty immediately. If the Congress tried to overturn it outright, they would have to do it within 35 days. We don't think that will happen. It's too difficult, and the president has to sign the bill, and I don't think he would. So we're talking, you know, next spring and summer. It's going to heat up then. And that's just our short-term approach. I mean, we have a few other things that I don't want to reveal right now just because I don't want anybody to be strategically prepared. But also, but on the statehood side of things, I mean, we do have a statehood bill. We would love to become a state along with Puerto Rico, but we see some problems with that. Not problems because it's Puerto Rico, but some political problems with Puerto Rico and D.C. going together. The main one being that D.C., when we're going with the paired model, Hawaii and Alaska, that was a Republican and Democratic state. We used to trade off slave states and non-slave states. It's a very long tradition in America. But Puerto Rico is just not clearly a Republican stronghold. It isn't. Their parties aren't even organized as Republicans and Democrats. So that one's a little tough. Puerto Rico is a big place. I mean, people don't realize how big Puerto Rico is. States that have come in have usually come in with a population that meant you got two senators and one member of Congress. They would come in with six seats, four members of the House and two senators. So, that's a far different animal than what the District of Columbia would be. I think there would certainly be balance politically, but I don't think there would be a guaranteed balance. And so that'll make it tough. All of that said, if the people of Puerto Rico, which we are fully supportive of them voting on their own status, if the delegate and the governor of Puerto Rico, who I'm sure in the earlier segment you indicated has not supported statehood, the newly elected governor, but if they decide they want to start moving this forward in the Congress, present it to the president, and that kind of thing, and there is some momentum building for it, we will definitely try to pair up with them. It might provide additional political support for Puerto Rico if we do pair up with them. I mean, I think it's a win-win situation. So that's where we stand right now, and, you know, that may be our most likely path to statehood, even though it's kind of a long shot.
Well, thank you so much, James, yes, for joining us today and weathering our technological storm.
No problem. I've been in your
thank
seat
you
before.
So much.
It happens all the time.
We will be returning to the subject and inviting you back to do a more detailed presentation on this very important issue.
Okay, great.
Thank
well,
so
we
much.
Appreciate that. Bye.
Thank you. And thank you for listening, and again, pardon us for this technological theft that we can't control at this time, but we will return to each other tomorrow, God willing, and the crates don't rise. Thanks. Bye-bye.